Welcome to Let's Talk Small Talk, the monthly podcast hosted by Small Talk Speech and Language Therapy. Join us as we talk all things speech, language, and communication. Each episode, we'll bring you interviews, discussions, and updates surrounding the art of communication. Now, let's dive straight into today's episode.
So, good morning, Paula. I am absolutely delighted to be able to have you on here today. So, people might not know that I've actually known you for a few years now. I was always impressed because you've always been so self-assured, so knowledgeable. I met you first with your work for Touch the Spectrum, and I saw you fighting the system, not just for your child, but for so many other children. You always seem so together and to know exactly what was needed to be done. When you had the stroke, was it 3 years ago now?
Yeah, 3 years ago.
I was actually miserable for about 3 days because it just seems so unfair. You know, why you? Why you when you'd got so much to offer? And so I was miserable for about 3 days. And then I realised, actually, that fighting spirit that you'd put into fighting for everybody else would come through. And I was right. So I am so pleased with the way that things have panned out. So I was lucky enough to come to your book launch at Western Hall the other Saturday. So it was interesting to hear more about the book. Obviously, I had read it beforehand. I was lucky to read it beforehand. But what made you want to write the book?
Well, the thing that I always said is that I wanted to make a really big difference for families that were in my situation, particularly when I started off. When Tim had his diagnosis, it was very much, this is the end of the world. It was very negative on based on what he couldn't do. So it was all based on this deficit approach, so that it was all very, well, actually, you know, his life's over, he's never going to work, he's never going to go to university. He was five, he's 26 now, so so it's a big difference. But I remember coming out of the clinic, walking into what was at the time Tesco's car park, because that's where we parked. The clinic was by Tesco's. We came out into the car park and I looked up and thought, everybody's life is going on completely normally and mine has just been shattered. When Bex got her diagnosis at 16, it was a completely different experience. It was how fantastic she was. This just gave her clarity. She had these amazing problem-solving skills. And it was all from a very different angle. Bex herself said, I'm no different today than I was yesterday. I've just got a label. And that was probably what really changed my understanding of autism. So for 10 years, I went round with this very negative overview. Thankfully, because I've been in the system and I work with some amazing autistic advocates, I was able to change that view much earlier. And I guess that when I set up Touch the Spectrum, and then when I wrote the book, it was very much based about around changing things for other families. Because when we got that diagnosis, we were lost. We were given a piece of paper with another parent's phone number on, no information about autism, everything I had to look up on the internet as it was then. And it was all about cures and all about things, Tim being lost to autism. And it's not that at all. It's not like that at all. Tim and Bex are both incredibly creative, beautiful, fantastic human beings. And actually, we've got great minds.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic minds.
But that is what's sold, isn't it? So I saw somebody telling another person that their child was just diagnosed as autistic, and the person said, Oh, I am sorry. And I said, oh, hang on a
Yeah.
minute, hang on a minute. Why are you sorry? And they said, oh, but it, you know, that's going to be awful. Their life's going to be ruined. And of course, you know, that's rubbish, absolute rubbish, isn't it?
Tim has a saying that it's the society that disables him, not the autism. And he's very, very clear. And now I'm using a wheelchair. I can so clearly see that, because the only reason I can't get to places because is they're not accessible to me. And that has blown my mind. I mean, in a way, the stroke has been really useful in some ways. It's not, there's nothing good about it, I'm going to be honest. But because I have an acquired brain injury, it means that sensory wise, I can't tolerate things the same. I can't cope with things the same. I get really easily overwhelmed. But I'm also, and so I'm seeing things from Tim's perspective. I've always understood it because I could visually see it, and I knew enough about children to be able to go, actually, he's not being naughty or disobedient. He just physically can't do this.
Yeah.
So that whole thing, but it's been interesting to be able to see things from a different perspective.
Yeah, I bet it has. I mean, he does have a really good way with words, doesn't he, Tim? I mean, that's actually how I described it to the person who thought it was a shame. You know, I said that there's absolutely nothing wrong with being autistic. The only limitations will be those from the environment, because obviously the environment can be limiting, just as Tim said. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed meeting Tim because he was talking about how he sees in pictures, wasn't he? And I hadn't come across that then, so I assumed that everybody had that internal monologue in their head, that little voice that speaks to them. And then obviously since Tim said that, I've known to ask that question. And so many people do think in pictures.
And I mean, the first time it sort of I realized for me was that after Tim had a massive breakdown in 2013, and after that, I think before that he hadn't found his voice. He used me as his advocate, and I'll talk a bit more later on about the parent blaming, but he used me as the advocate. And I was his voice. But then in 2013, he had to find his voice. We were very fortunate that we found an advocate that is just still with us now, but he was amazing and is amazing. But Tim began to find his voice, first of all, through art. And now he does these, he when you say, you ask him a question and he doesn't immediately know the answer, he'll draw it. Or he has to be prompted to draw it, and then he's got the words because he's drawn it. So he's taken it out of his head, which I think is intriguing. But we realised that things weren't quite right from thing in terms of his language from way back, because he used to take things. So I'll use an example of this ball, and I'd say to him, "Go and get your ball." And then I said it in a different environment for a different ball. And he looked at me and had no idea what to do. So the word ball meant something else because it was just specifically that ball. And then he did it again with the word create. Create was an activity that I used to do with the church for. It was a noisy, loud, fun. We did singing. The whole thing was about a children's club, and it was very loud, and that was what create was. So when he was told in art to create something, he just looked at them completely lost. And what he says is he puts, so in when he learns something, he puts the picture in his head. Then when he comes across it again, and if it's not making sense, he has to put in a new picture in his head. And that happens with every single thing. So if you think of the word light, Tim's got like 15 pictures in his head of what light means. And so each time that you get to that point where you come across something or he comes across something, he's got to go searching through this library to see which one it means, which one it is indicating. And that absolutely blew my mind. I was just astounded. And actually, when he said that, I was able to explain it to the social workers and everybody else much easier. However, they couldn't get their brains around it.
What a shame. Because like me, it blew my mind. And as I say, since then, I've met other people who say, yeah, well, isn't that normal? But I hadn't come across it before. I also like the way with Tim, how he uses songs and song lyrics to conjure up how he feels. Because I remember one meeting, he wanted to play a song, didn't he? And they wouldn't allow him. They wouldn't listen. And yet, those lyrics and the overall feeling that was evoked by the song was exactly what he wanted to put across. How clever is that?
And he's that in that meeting, they took away his voice.
Yeah.
And that for me now is a big problem. I mean, at the time, you just go with it, don't you? But that is something that he's done probably since 2013, where he's put his feelings to lyric to a song. And we've been in meetings where and I wish I could remember the song where he's said how desperate he's feeling, and he's found a song, and it's made me go, good grief, that is really quiet. He's really not in a good place. And he's also been in meetings where the song has said, you care more about money than you do about me. And I was a bit like, oh God.
Yes, but he's right.
But
he's
it's
right.
His voice. And that for me is what makes the difference.
Yeah, definitely. Brilliant. So in the book, you talk about your approach. So the live well approach. So can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of been, when I say it's sort of been my life's work, that sounds hilarious because it makes it sound like it's something magnificent. But it's something that sort of occurred to me over the years. So I believe that there is, that everybody has a toolbox, and that toolbox has basically a whole load of tools, and some tools will be, you know, multi-tools and that you can use them in different situations. Some tools are specific to a situation, and some tools, we've come up with this as power tools, so you can use them across the board for big things. Tim calls me his power tool.
You are.
So I've just been a tool for a long time, but now I'm a power tool.
Promotion.
But basically, what I came up with is that there are four aspects to your life that if you can get those four things right, then you can very clearly, they're like cornerstones of a house. So they fix the position of the house, and then you build your house based on these four cornerstones. So you build your own house. So you create your own very, you know, personalized sort of life toolbox and life for yourself that fits your family. And my book's called Your Life, Your Family, Your Way. And that is exactly that. So the live well approach is basically the W is for well-being, and that's basically practicing daily habits that sort of protect your emotional and your physical well-being, and that I think is absolutely key. The energy balance part, so the E is energy balance. And that's all about being aware of your daily energy levels. So for somebody like me who has a chronic illness, that is absolutely vital. So it's based on pacing and the spoons approach and energy accounting. It's based on those approaches. But all of those meant I have to do things like adding up and being aware of being counting and taking things away and all of that. Whereas it's just for the energy balance, it's just about being aware of where your levels are each time. So again, you can work out, because for me, some of the others, a lot of like things like socialing, being, peopling, as we call it, that's really exhausting. So it's about being aware that actually I need to build myself up for peopling, and then I need to give myself time afterwards. The L of low arousal is low arousal, and that's all about stress levels, being aware of your stress levels that are in your body, but in the environment, the people, the tasks you're trying to do, how motivated you are, and all of that sort of thing. Because all of those affect your arousal levels, your stress levels. So if you get too stressed, then things will be impossible. And I know if I'm in a loud environment, I can tolerate much less. In the same way as if somebody's shouting at me, there's no way I'm going to be able to get through that. So it's just being aware of, your surroundings and what you're doing. And then the loving life one, that's the last L, is all about being grateful, experiencing, enjoying life, being, practicing things like gratitude, and sort of having that hope that things are going to be better in the future. So it's a sort of optimism, that whole. So you're very grateful for what for the good things in your life. I'm actually grateful for some of the bad things because some good things have come out of it. But it's about sort of that whole gratitude, hope, and optimism that things are going to get better. And I just believe that if you're not experiencing some kind of joy every day, you're not looking for it because it's there.
I would agree with that actually. Just walking in the park this morning with the dogs and seeing the green hue on the bushes now, and the sun was just coming out, and the glimmers are there if you're
Oh
looking
yeah,
for
absolutely.
them.
And I've not realized all of these things all in one go, and I've not done all of these things all in one go over the years, but I am now. I'm making sure that my well-being is absolutely. They found that for me is the big decider. Then my energy levels, I monitor my energy levels and I keep going, well, actually, today I really need to do things that are going to build my energy. And this is where the well-being helps because the well-being and the energy fit together brilliantly. Then the low arousal stuff, I listen to my stress now. If I'm starting to feel overwhelmed, I back away. And I give myself space. And actually, when you do that, you become more able and more physically aware of being able to do more, which has been really important for my stroke. Previous to my stroke, it was absolutely key for us supporting Tim because Tim was very explosive as a child. It's the best phrase, really. Explosive as a child, and so we had a very low arousal house, but then I applied it to me after the stroke, and then the loving life is something I've discovered over the last couple of years that actually in 2021 it could have been over, and
Easily.
it wasn't, and actually I'm going to make sure what do they say, squeeze the juice out of every single day. That's what I'm going to do. And even on the bad days, there's always joy in there somewhere.
I mean, I enjoyed the book because I feel that it pulls together. So all the things that you've learned over the years, it pulls that all together. And that phrase, you can't pour from an empty cup. So I've been recommending it to lots of parents who are fighting for their children. Maybe they're fighting for an educational placement, or they're fighting for an EHCP, or they're fighting social services. So I've been recommending it for them because, I see them just getting so worn down, so totally taken over by what they're going through, that they can't actually, see any other way or any, they can't see beyond that really. And of course, that isn't good for them or their health, and it isn't actually good for the child either. So I've been recommending it for parents, but actually, it's a book anybody could read and enjoy,
Yeah, absolutely.
because
I mean,
it does.
I and And say, I know that I'm in part of some stroke groups on Facebook, and I know that a couple of times people that have had strokes have looked at it and said, actually, this is really good. I've used it in with families that have got other issues going on, and I shared it with somebody who has gone through cancer and is recovering from that, and she's using it now. So
Brilliant.
it's an approach that could be just transferred, hopefully, into whatever situation. And everybody that has tried it has gone, well, actually, this works for us. And the reason it works for them is because it's their life, their family, their way. And it's that whole thing of actually, it's not the answer to everything, but it can provide a structure.
Yeah. And I think that's really important because what I find is, especially the families with the neurodivergent children who probably are neurodivergent themselves, professionals are coming in and saying things to them like, you've got to be stricter, you've got to put firmer boundaries in, get rid of that iPad, etc., etc. Well, actually, this gives them the reasons why they can stand up and say, you know, well, I know my child better. They need that low arousal approach. The iPad is there as one of the energy accounting paybacks for a neurodivergent child. So there's so much to it that I feel can empower parents to say, hang on a minute, this is my family, like it says, my way. And it isn't right for somebody to come in and start telling people what to do, particularly if they're not looking at it through a neurodivergent lens.
I said when we were going through all of these things, I remember saying to the head teacher at the time, when you're here to come and help me at 3 o'clock in the morning when my son's not sleeping, then you can tell me. First, at the time it was about picking him up because he wasn't coping. I said, then you can tell me to come pick him up. But now after that, I said that to a number of like social workers. I mean, if you're there at 3:30 to help me, then I will take, I will be interested in what you're saying. And I'm not saying about throwing out all the advice. Lee Burden, he has a phrase where, and he's probably stolen it from somebody else, but it's that phrase of listen to everybody, but follow no one. And it's about going, well, this works for us. And I've got a, I have this thing that if it's working for you, nobody else is living in your home. Nobody else is living and doing what you have to do. Whether it's something that is, to do with behavior or something to do with sitting at the table and eating, if that's what you want to do. And that's okay. Because I do know that, I don't, if I talk about Rachel,
Yes,
I've
she
forgotten
won't
the
mind.
surname. I only know her as Rachel Tenacious, but I think everybody's Rachel
That's her
Tenacious.
social media presence,
Yeah,
isn't it?
it's a bit like me and being Paula Poppy.
Yeah.
Everybody knows me as Paula Poppy, but I'm not at all. So, but if I talk about things that I've done with Rachel, we would do a parent session, and we would say that things like eating, for me, eating at the table was important because my needs is I can't bear food in the carpet. I can't bear food all over the place. When the little children were little, it was worth battling that because that was a fight for me that was worth having. But for Rachel in her house, she was much more, laid back, and actually, so long as her daughter ate, she didn't care where she ate. And that was so it's just about things like that and going, well, actually, is this really important to me? Is this a battle I need to be having? I know lots of people that would just said he's eating, let it go.
I like that phrase. I mean, Rachel often says, "Derm, does it really matter?" And if it does matter to you, then obviously it's worth pursuing. But if it doesn't matter, then there's no point in sort of wasting the energy on it. And there are lots of things where there are, you know, that, oh, well, we have to do it this way, or we should be doing that way. But actually, when you look at it, does it really matter? And I think schools find that hard.
The lovely thing is that the DERM principle is something that I sort of made up. Somebody once said to me, does it really matter, Paula? And I went, actually. So I then coined it. And so it's funny now, because the DERM principle is something that people actually use that. They use it as a phrase. But honestly, it's probably one of the best pieces of advice that I've ever been given, that I've then given that to other people. So it's lovely that Rachel's using it as well now.
Yeah, oh,
it's
definitely.
Like one of those moments to
a daughter.
I get something right.
Yeah, definitely did. And I'm using it a lot, and I'm passing that on to families. So, because the other thing that that you were responsible for, in from my point of view, was I was using a low arousal approach, but I didn't know it was called that. So I some years ago had been on it was a family construct therapy course, and I'd come across the principle that we had to be kind to other people, that everybody has an ego, you mustn't bruise that ego, and it's actually quite powerful. So if you're respectful. So I first of all started to use that in my work with the children. So I stopped. So it was actually 1986. So I actually stopped telling the children what to do in my sessions, and suggested we could do this, or would they like to do this or this. Then when I became a parent, that was very much how I did it, to a lot of criticism from other people who felt, well, why are you pandering to them? Just tell them. But I also used it in my work. So I'd been going into schools and saying, right, okay, well, this child needs this, this, and this. And I was met with a too busy, sorry. So I used the same principles to say, okay, well, the child really needs X, Y, and Z. How can you help me with this? And everybody said yes. But it was when I met you that you were talking about this low arousal approach. And I thought, well, actually, that fits in with exactly how I feel. And so tell us a bit about the low arousal approach.
So the low arousal approach, well, I came across it when back when Tim was six or seven. Basically, I now know he was in crisis. It's probably the first time that he'd been properly in crisis. And it was coming out as explosive, aggressive, violent behaviour. And I was kicked, scratched, bitten, and all sorts. And the social workers, because they got involved, the social workers basically stomped through our house wearing hobnail boots. Everything I was doing was wrong. I was letting him get away with things. I wasn't being consistent, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All the things that we've all heard. And I decided, I spoke to people because I was working in the school, and I spoke to people. And teachers were being trained in things like team teach and restraint. And so I was a bit like, well, okay, if they're getting taught it, who's teaching us as parents? So I then went on this massive search for various approaches, and I ended up coming across something called Practical Interventions with Autism West Midlands. And Richard and I went, I think it was about a six-week course over 12 weeks. And it was almost, that makes no sense. That was a 12-week course in six sessions. Try that one again.
Got it.
So it was that whole thing of where we had to go over to the other side of Birmingham. So for us, it was quite a long way. We had to arrange babysitters, which meant that we were calling in sort of favours, and you have to be careful about, what you call in. So we got babysitters. We went across to the other side of Birmingham. We attended this practical interventions course, and we learned techniques, not for restraint, but to step back or to make the child safe, But most importantly, we learned about autism, and we learned about autism from an autistic viewpoint. And all I can say is, from that point forward, things started to change. And I've sort of, I bought into it completely, 100%, because number one, I didn't have to restrain him. And it felt wrong for a grown woman, let alone a grown couple, two adults, having to restrain a six-year-old child. It's wrong. There is nothing right about it. Yes, he often wanted hugging. Yes, he wanted, you know, the deep pressure, but that's not restraint, because he's still in that situation where he can get out of it. So I then became very interested in this whole restraint side of things. The approach that Autism West Midlands did was the low arousal approach. So I have this particular type of brain that likes learning. I then did the whole thing of learning as much as I possibly could about it. I did that, and then I started to go, well, actually, I then went on another couple of courses. Then I heard, but I came across Bo Elvin. I'm not even going to attempt to say his surname.
No, me neither.
Then I came across Peter Vermeulen.
I don't know him.
He is, I want to say, a psychologist. We went to an autism conference, and I went with Rachel. And I realised that the low arousal approach was this approach, was this is what we were doing. And then it was at that conference, Peter spoke about happiness and autism, and about the need for autistic people to be happy too. And it was almost like the pen dropped. So for me, it became very important that my children and us as a family were happy, and that we were calm, because the low arousal approach is all very much around avoiding frustration and confusion and, you know, crisis situations. And it's just about using a whole range of strategies to achieve that, to avoid those situations. The other thing about the low arousal approach was it was very much a non-punishment way of doing things, because I was aware that sitting Tim on the bottom step, which is what, you know, we've all been brought up to think, sitting him on the top bottom step was a reward. He absolutely loved the bottom step. And when I said to social workers that we weren't using that, then that obviously got written down. So we started to adopt the bottom step, which then went to the middle step, because the children were too big for that. But we then did the whole thing of, actually, if you want time out, if you're overwhelmed, so you can take yourself to the bottom step. So we did that for years. And even as adults, we would take ourselves to the bottom step.
Time out to regulate.
And it was just time out to regulate, absolutely. And it was our choice.
Yeah.
So the whole punishment thing became it became something I focused on. So like, if things went everywhere, toys went everywhere, if I was to say to him and hand over hand put things in the away, all I was doing was stressing him.
Yeah.
But actually, he would willingly come and help me if I was doing it in a fun way. Standing there and going, where is that Lego man? I've seen him somewhere, and of course it was right there in front of me. But do you get what I'm saying? It's that whole thing of being creative, being very, very, very undemanding, and being very aware of my response and my instructions. How he would respond to those. So that was really helpful. Then I discovered about the window of tolerance. I could talk about low arousal for hours, but this window of tolerance, if you can keep within this window of tolerance, actually, you can be really good. So if you start to dysregulate, there are strategies you can put in place to come back into the window of tolerance. But it, obviously, it's taken years to work it all out and to get to the point. And even now, we talk about them as grenade moments where you can see things. You can almost see something's going to happen. And then you take out the, you know, the pin and you throw this grenade into the situation and it all explodes. And you just get, you sat there going, why did I do that? Why did I let that happen? But what I've learned is you have to be really compassionate to yourself and go, okay, it happened. We can clear up the mess afterwards and we can, you know, calm down and then we can talk about what's happened and deal with it that way. So that whole analogy of you not being able to teach a child to swim in when they're falling in the pool, it's that whole thing of actually teach at the right times and then go in and rescue when needs you need to rescue.
I think that's absolutely brilliant advice. I like that quote from Bo Elvin, where, because he's got the series of videos on YouTube, hasn't he? And one of the thing is, if the child says no, you're asking the wrong question.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's a different way to ask the question, and then they won't. Yeah. It won't be a no.
The other one that I really like from him is that who's got the problem?
Yes. Yes.
And I would discover that 9 times out of 10, it was me that had the problem. Yeah. You know, I wanted them to clear the table, for example, and they couldn't see the point of it. What was the point of doing that? I've had my dinner, thank you very much. I'm going to watch Neighbours now. And things like washing. For Tim at the time, he hated baths. He liked them as a toddler, but as a sort of 10-year-old, he absolutely hated them. And it was that whole thing of, actually, why are we battling with this? When he'd have a shower, yes, he'd make a mess. Yes, it would be chaotic. Yes, the shower curtain was regularly pulled down. But he was clean. So what is the purpose of the activity you're doing? And who has that problem with that activity? Is it you? Well, actually, you're old enough, ugly enough, and all the rest to go, I can deal with that right now. If that table needs clearing, I'll just do it because it's my problem. So it's that's another one of his. In fact, that whole series is worth watching. And even now, I go back to it and remind.
Yeah, me too, because it is so good. But it's so logical, it's so practical, and it's just flipping the narrative, isn't it? Looking at it through a different way, really. So a lot of the things that you have found useful is because you understand so much more about autism. We can't get acceptance without understanding. So you've been a crusader for autism acceptance for years. Where do you think we are now with that?
Well, sometimes I think we are so far ahead. I mean, especially when I think about Tim's diagnosis, I think we are so far ahead, particularly in terms of understanding masking. But we've come so far. So, I mean, Tim's involved in the All Age Autism Project. He has a job with the NHS on this All Age Autism Project. And he is amazing and they're doing big things. But at the same time, same with co-production, in some ways we're making massive, massive, massive steps. And then in understanding ourselves, that's another thing. And autistic advocates there are so many of really, really good ones. There are a few not so good, but when they're really good, they're usually really, really good. But then we have a situation where schools, and I'll use this as an example, but a school suspended a young lady a couple of weeks ago because she didn't respond appropriately in a situation where she felt threatened. The teacher was demanding too much, etc., etc. Now, the young lady has a diagnosis of PDA. She is a young lady that struggles to go to school because she has emotionally based massive school anxiety. And they suspended her. And it's almost like, are you stupid? And the fact that this is happening now, even though that young lady has got all that information, then I think we've not made progress. And it's just what those sorts of things that make me go. And the other thing is, like in co-production, we made big steps and then they ignore the voices, the autistic voices in that when they're talking about parents and media providing autistic services. And it's almost like, why would you ignore autistic voices if you're wanting to make a change? So in some ways, I think we've made big steps. And then in other ways, I just think, oh, God.
I mean, I'd agree. I mean, I see some really good practice. But then, you know, yesterday in a tribunal, I was saying that the child needed child-led, interest-based, built on secure connections and relationships. I wanted to have a high-tech AAC device because he's a Gestalt language processor. So that goes hand in hand. And what was being argued for was compliance-based, loads of PECs, lots of ABA-type strategies, must have eye contact. He's got to show that he's listening. And I felt so depressed because I thought this shouldn't be happening. Not now.
And as a teacher, when I went into teaching, I went in to it because I wanted to make a difference. When I first did my training, it was all based on thematic learning and child-led learning. Mm-hmm. And when the EYFS was brought in, then it was all based on child-led learning and lots of observation. And then all of a sudden you get to sort of primary school, primary age, and then secondary school, and it's all about compliance. And I just think, well, they don't marry, it doesn't fit. But I just think that that's something that is going to change because it has to. They can't carry on in this way.
No, particularly with the epidemiology of neurodivergence growing, you know, one in 20 ADHD. The figures for autism are very up in the air, aren't they, at the moment? It's certainly more than the 1% that we've been quoting. There's a study at UCL at the moment that Liz and Ines was talking about where one in 38 boys between 11 and 13 on one particular project have turned out to be autistic. So the figures are moving. It's got to change because we all respond to human relationships and to building those relationships rather than a compliance-based system where you're anonymous.
I was at a conference on Thursday and Friday last week, and there were 400 people there. I might have guessed that. 400 people there, and it's full of people that have small businesses, that are entrepreneurs, and the majority, I would say, were neurodivergent people because they've gone away and gone, actually, this system doesn't work for me. Let's do it properly.
Yeah.
Let's do it my way. And it was one of the most inclusive conferences. No, it was the most inclusive conference that I've ever, ever been on.
Excellent. That sounds
so
really good.
It's possible. This is the thing that frustrates me more than anything, is it is possible. Yes, it's hard work, but show me something that isn't hard work.
I'd agree entirely. There's something that sort of fits in with this that is my current, or one of my current bugbears, one of the current things I'm getting upset about. I've just been on the advisory panel for an NHS England sponsored parental blame survey. So it's basically looking at autistic parents and the parental blame procedure that's going on. So we're not quite ready to publish that yet. But what's your experience and view on parental blame for autistic parents?
Well, you said at the beginning about me being I'm going to use the wrong phrase, but self-assured and knowledgeable and in control.
Yes.
I realise now that going back, I know that I was that way. I used to joke about being a great actress, but I realise now that that was masking. And I can see I was masking. And yeah, there were positives. Masking is a great tool for getting through, faking it till you make it type stuff. But there comes a point where the masking is actually, I'm not saying it's a negative thing, but it has a negative impact. So for me, apart from it being exhausting and it made me incredibly anxious about being discovered a fake and being discovered as somebody who didn't really know what she was doing. It led to some pretty brutal, let's just say, descriptions of me.
Really?
I was known as a nightmare parent. I was known as aggressive. I mean, I know it's hilarious. I'm a nightmare parent. But I was known as being manipulative and controlling. And it was that whole thing of actually it was very negative. And that's, I think the whole parent blame culture is massive. And I think it's in everything right from, I had a miscarriage in my early stages of marriage, and I miscarried. And the phrases they use is "you've lost a baby." I mean, how can this? Then when I had my children, they were both failure to thrive, and it's all very negative and blame based. Well, then when you get into children's services and your child's not necessarily meeting the developmental stages and is not behaving in an appropriate way, then you as parents are considered at fault. When Tim struggled to go to school, they told me, when he was little, I just got him to school, whatever it took. But when he was 15 and he struggled to go to school, they told me to get him in whatever it took. He was 15 and he was a big lad then. I'd like to see me try getting him in my Minecraft. Didn't work. It wasn't going to work. But it's that whole thing of they don't know another way. So I know myself that I found myself in situations where I've judged a parent on things. This is the problem of stereotypes. They're ingrained. They're there when you don't even know it. And so when I realise that that's the view I'm taking, I sort of give myself a big kick up the bum and apologise. When I'm in a meeting and I see it happening, I now call people out and say, you know, do you realise that this is, you know, gaslighting and bullying and all of those things? People don't like you saying those words. It's hilarious. But it's that whole situation where they're going, oh. And if they then, if people then go, I'm sorry, or, you know, you can see some kind of dawning on their face and then attitudes change, well, then you can be forgiving and all the rest. What I realise is that sometimes parent blame is because either it's covering their backs or it's because they're frightened of being seen as vulnerable because they don't know what they're doing. They're pretty much guessing at what's happening and what they've got, how to respond to it. The issue I have is when it's systemic. And that it goes beyond individuals. And that is my experience of children's services, both within education and social care, and actually in the medical system as well, to a certain degree, is that actually the blame culture out there and the shaming culture out there is really big. So that's what concerns me. And I think it's particularly difficult for autistic parents, is that actually you've got the whole communication thing going on, and you've got your own sensory situation, you've got your own structure. And when it's exactly what you said, it's looking at things through a neurodivergent lens. They're not. They're looking at things through a very neurotypical lens, and they're judging neurodivergent parents with the wrong set of glasses. So it would be like wearing me wearing short-sighted glasses when I'm actually long-sighted. It's just completely wrong. They're not going to work. So as far as that goes, I mean, as in terms of my experience, I've been very, very badly gaslit and bullied by our local authority. And not just once, probably three or four times, to the point where at one stage, they were, you know, I was in a situation where they were accusing me of abusing Tim. And I've even had a social worker who said, it's basically Munchausen's. We're basically accusing you of Munchausen's. And part of me goes, well, you don't actually mean that, because it's this, and you've got your wording wrong there, because that's my brain.
Yeah, which would make it worse if you said it.
I know. I did. It was one of the few occasions when I did keep my mouth shut. Yeah. And it was almost like, actually, that is really serious, because I was a teacher teaching in a school at the time. And my head teacher said to me, thank you for coming and telling me about this, but if they decide to open an investigation, then we are going to have to suspend you until it's finished.
That's awful.
Now, years back, we were in a situation where social services were back. This is when Tim was smaller. We're in a situation where social services intervened. They then decided to investigate something, but they never came back to us to tell us what the result was.
Oh, no.
They left us dangling.
In limbo. I mean,
at the time we were like, and this is when we ended up at the practical interventions course. But we sent Bex to my sister's for a week or two to try and get some kind of normality into the home with Tim, because it was a horrible situation.
Sounds it. Well, we're hoping to disseminate the results of this survey as far and wide as we can, and see what we can actually do to make a difference with it, because there's no point in having done the project without making sure that we can get it spread as wide as possible.
And I have a theory that it's that whole dripping tap theory. If we keep dripping, eventually somebody will fix the system. So I just think we have to keep dripping.
We do have to keep dripping. And on that note, I will say thank you very much for talking to me today, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Let's Talk Small Talk. If you like what you heard, then be sure to hit like and subscribe. And why not share with other like-minded people? Until next time, take care and remember, communication is everything.